Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program, and happy Memorial Day. I hope that you and your family are observing a very happy and meaningful Memorial Day. I'll tell you my concern. My concern is not that Americans won't find a way to have fun on Memorial Day. Americans are good at that. And we love and cherish our national holidays, especially when they create a three-day weekend. And what we were told at the beginning of this weekend is that this may be an absolute record week in terms of families on interstate highways traveling for special events. It may be the beginning of a summer season to break all records after some of the diminished travel time and vacation plans of the previous couple of years. Looks like Americans are now ready to get on the go and go have some fun. And together as a family, that is a magnificent thing. But let me just give you a word of exhortation. As you're listening this afternoon and thinking about Memorial Day, do not let the day pass for yourself or for your family without pondering a moment why we have this holiday and what it means. What it means to recognize, to celebrate, and to valorize the fact that there have been millions of Americans who have given their lives in the service to this nation through its armed forces, and it is by their gift of their valor and their courage and their commitment that we're able to have the country we know today, to experience the freedoms that we cherish today, and even to experience and to celebrate the holiday that marks this day. There's so much behind this, of course, just in the history of the Memorial Day holiday, and just the recognition that it is very important we recognize those who've died in the service of their country. And yet, even as we valorize, especially those who died in the service of their country, we are also reminded of so many who today are living that legacy. The veterans who have lived to survive our various wars, and thousands and thousands of whom are alive today. This is a good opportunity for us to remember that freedom is never free, that indeed it always comes with a cost, and that cost is often, indeed, horrifyingly often, in the form of human lives. In a fallen world, in a Genesis 3 world, where there are those who would take power and use power, there are those who would take life and destroy life, there are those who would use whatever means to gain their ends, war being one of those means. In a world such as that, we have to have an armed services ready, made up of people who are willing. And what is required of them often is not only a commitment to bravery and courage, but their lives. I was just reading an obituary. It's one of those things that catches your attention, and it happened this past Friday. As the Memorial Day weekend began, there was a major obituary, about a quarter of a page, in the New York Times. It was for a man by the name of John W. Finn. He died at age 100 as a Navy veteran. He was noted for heroism and received the Medal of Honor for his victorious his service, his indeed very costly service in that attack upon Pearl Harbor. He was able to celebrate the victory of America over those that had attacked us in 1941. But on that day, December 7, 1941, he was asleep with his wife when he heard the commotion. And as he ran out and he saw what was going on, he quickly got dressed and he headed for the Naval Air Station at Kanahoe Bay, where indeed he was serving. Mr. Finn was a chief petty officer in charge of munitions at the Naval Station, a veteran of 15 years in the Navy, according to the New York Times. As he dressed hurriedly and drove to the Naval Station, he was overcome by an attacking plane. As he saw the plane, he saw on it that big, ominous red dot. The rising sun of Japan. He knew that his nation was under attack, that indeed his colleagues and fellow soldiers, his comrades, were under attack. He said, "I heard the plane come roaring in from astern ahead of me," and goes on and explained, "As I glanced up, this guy made a wing over, and I saw that big old red meatball, the rising sun insignia on the underside of the wing. Well, I threw it into second, and it's a wonder I didn't run over every sailor in the air station." Now get this, this is just a reminder of the kind of valor that America has produced. When Chief Finn arrived at the hangars, many of the planes had already been hit. He recalled that he grabbed a .30 caliber machine gun on a makeshift tripod, carried it to an exposed area near a runway, and began firing. For the next 2.5 hours, he blazed away, although peppered with shrapnel as Japanese planes strafed the runways with cannon fire. Quote, I got shot in the left arm and shot in the left foot, broke the bone. I had shrapnel blows in my chest and belly and right elbow and right thumb. Some were just scratches. My scalp got cut and everybody thought I was dying. This man had 28 or 29 holes in him that were bleeding by the end of the first wave of the attack. He said of himself, my left arm didn't work. It was just a big ball hanging down. He hoped he'd hit at least one plane, but he didn't know whether he brought it down. He nonetheless at least served to fend off many attacking planes. On September the 15th, 1942, Chief Finn received the Medal of Honor from Admiral Chester W. Nimitz, Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet. He cited Chief Finn for his magnificent courage in the face of almost certain death. What really I find remarkable about this particular story, and there's so many remarkable aspects of it, is that this man, having been shot up with 28 or 29 holes bleeding in his body, he went and received first aid, and then he returned to await a second possible attack at his station, at his gun, at that tripod. He did not go to the hospital until the following afternoon. It's a wonder he was alive. It's the kind of heroism that is reflected there that has bought us our freedom. He was born, by the way, July 23rd, 1909, in Los Angeles. It turns out there were 15 servicemen who received the Medal of Honor for their actions at Pearl Harbor. 10 of those 15 died in the attack. So two-thirds of those who received the Medal of Honor due to valor at the Battle of Pearl Harbor upon that attack, they died before it was over. That include Rear Admiral Isaac C. Kidd, commander of Battleship Division 1, who was aboard the Arizona when it blew up and sank. Four of the Pearl Harbor recipients survived the war. So one that survived Pearl Harbor did not survive the war. Four survived both Pearl Harbor and the war. And this particular man, John W. Finn, died just a few days ago at age 100. He died just before the Memorial Day weekend at age 100. He, by the way, lived long enough to be invited to a screening at Pearl Harbor of the movie that came out in 1999, Pearl Harbor. He said he liked the movie. It was a good movie, he told the Boston Herald. He said his favorite part of it was this, quote, I liked it especially, he said, because I got to kiss all those pretty little movie actresses. At about age 90. Well, Mr. Finn, who died last Thursday, is just a reminder to us of those who didn't even survive the battle and who didn't survive the war. There were so many who died, and as you go to a national cemetery and you get to see all those pale white stones in a row, you are reminded that freedom indeed is never free. This Memorial Day weekend, I hope that you and your family will take the opportunity to remember that Memorial Day is not just an opportunity for a wonderful cookout. It's not just the opening of the summer season. It's not just a great time to go see relatives and perhaps spend a nice weekend in a beautiful place on a lake or the seashore up in the mountains. It's also an opportunity to be reminded of the fact that we have this particular holiday for a very specific reason. And that reason is memory. We as human beings have a hard time with memory anyway. We're very busy people. We have a lot on our minds. We go from one thing to another. Our to-do list is never finished at the end of the day. We have a hard time remembering our own phone number, and much less, frankly, some of the bigger issues in life that should always be on our mind. And one of the things that is true of America, well, it was documented by Alexis de Tocqueville, even in the founding era of American history. He said, Americans believe they are especially blessed people. Well, we do. We do understand that we are a particularly blessed people. And the blessings, nonetheless, have often been won and purchased at an incredible price. This nation was won as a nation, born as a people in the crucible of war. It has been maintained through many different twists and turns in America's history by means of war. And no sooner had we won our independence than in the year 1812, we found ourselves at war once again with the British. Very quickly after that, we found ourselves in other wars that were mostly on the borders. And then in the middle of that 19th century came the war that actually gave birth to Memorial Day. And that was the Civil War, the war of state against state, brother against brother. After that, of course, we had such things as the Spanish-American War. And then the tumultuous entrance of the United States into the international scene in the early part of the 20th century in World War I. And then World War II, and then you just tick off the wars that have continued since then, Korea, Vietnam, Gulf War I, and now again in the Gulf and in the Middle East and Afghanistan and Iraq and around the world. You know, even as we're having this conversation today, there are Americans serving in places that are often out of sight. One of the hottest spots on the entire planet right now is on the border between North and South Korea. And on that border are not only those who are wearing the uniforms of those two respective countries, but thousands who are wearing the American uniform as well. The issue of life and death is not something that's just in the past. Memorial Day is a call to remember and a calendar tick to remind us to remember those who have fallen in service to this country. But as you're celebrating Memorial Day today, keep in mind also, we need to valorize those who are wearing the uniform even now. When we come back, we have a conversation with retired Lieutenant General Pat Caruana of the Air Force on how we, as individuals, as family, and as churches, can minister to those in uniform. A timely conversation we'll be replaying as a classic conversation. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Right now, all around the world, you will find Americans in uniform. It has been so ever since the American Revolution, and we understand that the military has had a very honored and special place in American life from the very beginning. But in a particular time as this, where we have soldiers in harm's way, soldiers, sailors, and airmen in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere in the world, it's important, I think, that we begin to think seriously, again, about how to minister to provide support for, to encourage the American military and American military families in particular. And I'm talking here about soldiers, sailors, airmen. I'm talking about those who are in uniform and the very real stresses and strains that they face. Every one of them, of course, has a story. And as I thought about addressing this issue, there's no one that I think is better situated to speak about this than retired Lieutenant General Pat Caruana of the United States Air Force. He commanded at several different levels. We're going to be talking about his story. He's here in the studio with his wonderful wife, Lorraine. And, General, it's just an honor to have you here.
Well, Dr. Mueller, it's truly an honor for us to be here with you today. Thank you very much.
Now, your story is one that I think that folks need to hear. I mean, after all, one of the big questions like anyone would have is how in the world do you become a three-star general in the Air Force? But you really started out as an enlisted man.
Yes, and it really goes before that, because from my earliest recollection, I was fascinated with airplanes. And I was growing up in the mid-40s, and one of the great opportunities that we would have as a family was to go to the airport and watch the airplanes come and go. And I was fascinated by that. And I had an affinity for aviation at the earliest age that I can remember, but really never thought that I would ever be able to get into an airplane and fly it.
But you did. And as a matter of fact, as I recall, you were flying planes until very recently, if not now.
Well, I still have the opportunity to fly, but I was able to be blessed enough to fly to the very end of my career. But it began actually before I could fly. And when I graduated from high school, I enlisted in the Air Force because the opportunity to go to college, given our financial status for our family, was somewhat limited. So I enlisted and became an aircraft mechanic and began working on airplanes and fixing them. And then, as Providence would have it, I had what I would call a significant emotional event one day when my airplane was broken in the middle of winter, and it took me over 4 hours to fix. And the crew came out after being in a nice warm building and took off and flew. And it took me 6 hours to warm up. And I said, in this scenario for the future as a 17-year-old young man, who do I want to be? And that was a highly motivating event for me to become a pilot. And seriously, right after that, I applied for the Air Force Academy.
And you went to the Air Force Academy?
Yes. I was blessed enough to be able to go and graduate in the class of 1963, began in 1959, and we were the fifth class to graduate from the Air Force Academy.
Fifth class. And, you know, I've had the opportunity to be there several times. It's a very inspiring place. But when I was out in Colorado Springs not long ago, I just stood out on a lawn and looked up and saw all these gliders overhead. And just imagine all these young people in these gliders. What's the story of how they actually become pilots?
Well, the process for cadets is that they have a screening program conducted at the Air Force Academy where they are able to have a certain number of flying hours leading to a solo. And that's a very, very cost-effective way to determine whether a cadet, either a male or female, has an aptitude for flying. And after that's completed, then upon graduation as a second lieutenant, they will go to one of the designated Air Force flying institutions, bases, around the country, and then go through a one-year program for primary flying training, which is what I was able to do as well.
Now, when you emerged from the Air Force Academy in the fifth class, what did you do next?
Well, I went directly to a pilot training base in Oklahoma and fulfilled that desire to be able to fly an airplane. And I can still remember vividly the day that I first soloed in a small jet trainer, a little T-37, which was a twin-engine jet airplane. And when that canopy closed and I looked over in the seat to my right and saw there was no instructor, it was just me in the airplane, that was a thrilling event and fulfilled a long, long time desire as a child to be able to fly an airplane.
There's not a man in this studio or booth today that's not jealous of that opportunity. We're all wishing we could have been there ourselves. But did you imagine when you were in that that thrilling first solo flight that by the time you would end your Air Force career, you'd have 3 stars?
I never imagined that, not in my wildest imagination, because, first of all, as a young officer, your goal is fairly immediate. I wanted to get through pilot training and then find out what my next assignment was going to be in the Air Force and then what I would do in that next assignment. So it was a progressive. Obviously, my goal was to succeed as best I could. And I will tell you, Dr. Moeller, in those early years, I was not a believer. And so even though there was a modest level of success in a professional vein, my life was still not fully successful until I had that encounter with the Lord, and then that really changed things.
And when did that happen?
That was actually in 1972. My wife and I had been married for 5 years at that point. I had just returned from my third tour in Southeast Asia, in fact, in Vietnam. And my roommate had been killed in a combat incident in Vietnam. And even though we were losing people, it was not out of the ordinary. For some reason, that incident really struck very, very close to home, obviously because of us being as close as we were on a day-to-day basis. And then having to bring his body back to his family was really an eye-opening experience for me. And the Lord used that. Not at that point, but later on after I got back to finally get my full attention, if I can say it that way.
And so you came to know the Lord Jesus Christ as Savior, and at that point your entire perspective, not only in the Air Force, but all the rest of life changed.
Well, and it did. And we were not schooled at all in God's Word. In fact, it was something that I knew about, but not very much in terms of a personal involvement. And that was one of the first things that the Lord began to do with our lives, is to rivet us and focus us into His Word and to see how it governed not only the spiritual aspects, as people would tell us, but it governed all of our lives. And very early on after that, within months of our becoming believers, both my wife and I came within days of each other, which was a blessing. The Lord spoke it into my heart through an understanding that I would not take my career as a concern. It was His. My responsibility was to serve Him, and in doing that, whatever happened in my career would be His choice.
When we come back in just a moment, I want to talk to you about what you've learned as a Christian about how Christians should minister to folks in the military, those who are in uniform and their families. And, you know, I think there's a particular poignancy to this right now because as America finds itself this particular point in history, Afghanistan and Iraq and all the rest, there are families who whose loved ones have had repeated tours. There are some right now who are living in the in-between time, wondering if they'll be called up again. And I think there are a lot of churches that really right now, a lot of Christians, don't know how rightly to relate to people in that situation, don't know how to pray for them, don't know how to encourage them. And don't know how to minister to their wives and children as well. When we come back, one of the first things we're going to do is listen to a story as recounted in a very recent edition of NBC's Nightly News. And some of you may have seen it. It's about a little boy welcoming his dad home, and it's one of the most powerful things I've seen or heard in a very long time. That'll set us up to talk about how we as Christians really have an opportunity and an obligation to minister to those in uniform and their families around us. The phone number is 877-893-8255 to join the conversation coast to coast and with listeners around the world. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Like many of Americans, in fact, millions of Americans, I was watching the Ken Burns documentary, The War, just a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things that I found most moving about that documentary was how it treated what was going on in the United States in the four selected towns, following the families, the communities, the churches of those who were in uniform during World War II. We need something like that right now. All those stories are happening around us right now. And, you know, when you look at the war, you're talking more than 50 years after the event. It's taken that long to tell some of these stories. When it comes to the war right now, when it comes to Iraq and Afghanistan, and there are certain of these stories coming out right now, and I have to tell you, one of the ones that is most powerful is one I saw for the first time just this morning. And let me tell you the setup on this. This is the return of Navy Petty Officer Bill Hawes, who lives in Seattle. And what you will hear here is an NBC News segment. They were there when Petty Officer Ensign Bill Hawes went and surprised his six-year-old son, John, in his first-grade class. This little boy's been looking for his daddy. He doesn't know his daddy's home, and his daddy shows up in his first-grade classroom. Just listen to what happens here.
Bill Hawes, a Seattle-area sailor who spent the last 7 months in Iraq, decided to surprise his six-year-old son at school. Reporter Alyssa Hahn of our affiliate King TV went along to witness this emotional reunion.
For the last 7 months, Bill Hawes has been in Iraq, an eternity for his family, especially his six-year-old son, who had no idea his dad was coming home and was surprising him in class. All year, the Cedro Woolley six-year-old had written letters to his dad, and his kindergarten class at Central Elementary joined in, sending the sailor care packages. A tearful John got to introduce his father to all his pen pals.
What's his name?
Bill.
This is Bill.
It's great to be home. 7 months over there. It's nice to see my kids and all again, and my wife.
I am so ecstatic. I'm so proud of him.
The Hawes family was happy to share their joy with the whole class, who all took part in the welcome home party. The sweetest homecoming for a sailor who had been gone too long, and for a little boy who dreamed of this day with his dad.
All right. Well, I guarantee you there's not a dry eye in the studio right here, and there wasn't with the folks with whom I saw that clip this morning. With me here in the studio is retired Lieutenant General Pat Caruana of the United States Air Force. And General, I just want to turn to you and say, when you see something like that, what do you think?
Well, I think of a father and a son first, Dr. Mohler, because that's really where it's at. That little boy doesn't see the uniform his daddy's wearing. What he sees is his daddy. And these are real people every day that are dealing with these issues, that are deployed, that are serving anywhere in many places around the world. The operations tempo for all our services has never been higher than it is right now. And so there are countless numbers of families around our nation and around the world, literally, who are experiencing this very same thing in one respect or another.
And I know from talking with you that you think a lot of Christians and churches are coming up short ministering to these individuals and their families.
Well, I'm not sure that they come up short, but with our experience, and I will tell you that we moved 24 times during my military career, and that's a lot of different churches. And one of the things that we experienced was sometimes, and it wasn't crude or mean, a reluctance on the part of some of the church communities to reach out to the military because they knew that in a year or two we would be gone and we wouldn't be a functioning member of that community. But that is really very difficult for a family to withhold.
You know, and my guess is that's not a cold-hearted calculation, as in this is not a good investment for us to make for our church. I think it could be even just a reluctance to establish emotional bonds with someone who you think is going to be taken away so soon.
That's exactly it. It is never done maliciously. It is never done consciously. It is just that reluctance to make that connection. because of the time.
When we come back, I'm going to ask General Caruana what these families really need from Christians and from a church, and how we can truly pray for and support those who are in uniform, and just so they know that Christians are praying for them and with them. And there are particular responsibilities that come to us in every generation. And, you know, for some time, American churches haven't had to think about this. For a number of years, there really wasn't the kind of military action of a prolonged nature that that really brought these matters to our attention. But that was then, and this is now. And that's why this is an important conversation. We'll be right back with Lieutenant General Pat Caruana in just a moment. I'm Albert Mueller. We're going to do our very best to get that video clip up on our website, so you'll be able to go just hit the Albert Mueller program, radio program button there at the website at albertmueller.com, and you'll find the link. We'll have it up there just as quickly as we can. That was the return of Petty Officer Bill Hawes from Seattle and his little boy John welcoming him. We talked about that just as we were getting ready to go into the break this last segment. My guest here in the studio, I'm very honored to have, retired Air Force Lieutenant General Pat Caruana, who's here in the studio with his wife, Lorraine, and they have their own story to tell. And when I was reflecting with him, with the general, about what we just heard in terms of this NBC News clip, he was telling me about something he'll never forget. General, just tell us that story.
Well, I was in a position in the United States when the first Gulf War, actually when Saddam invaded and took over Kuwait, to where I was responsible to leave on a very short notice and was called by my major headquarters and had an airplane waiting for me at the flight line. I'd just gone home to get the things that I needed to depart without any knowledge of where I was going or when I would come back. And my wife was there and with our son, who was 12 years old at the time, and we said goodbye, and as I walked to the car and got in the car, I looked back at him specifically, and there was a look on his face that will forever be etched in my memory of not knowing and wondering, and it was just one of those moments that was very, very painful for me, knowing that I had a responsibility to go. And that is what every one of our men and women in uniform face today. I mean, when they walk away from their families, whether they have children or not, they are departing from that secure base and the loved ones that they hold so dear. And I think we need to see them as the professionals that they are, but as real people who are facing some very, very unique problems.
So how should churches really understand the responsibility to minister to folks in this situation?
Well, first of all, I strongly suggest that if there are military folks or people, and nowadays it could be a lot more likely because the reserve and the guard, I mean, these people that live in your community day in and day out, they may be lawyers, they may be policemen, they may be whatever in their civilian job, but the next day they may be gone because they are part of a Guard or Reserve unit, is to extend the hand of fellowship to them in a very special way. As we've mentioned briefly before, sometimes that's a difficult thing because some of the communities don't want to get too close in terms of an association. But that is precisely what they need, is to be there and to extend the hand of fellowship and let them know that they're there for them and their family if they have to deploy. That's most important.
Now, if, for instance, you're talking to the wife or the spouse along with children, you know, how should a really sensitive and caring Christian friend talk to a family or a wife in that situation?
Very honestly, Dr. Mueller, acknowledge the situation that they're in. I mean, if you try to gloss this over, it just doesn't work because that comes over in a very disingenuous way. Just to acknowledge that and to be there as a friend, as a comforter, somebody to be a buddy, depending on whether it's a man or a woman, because nowadays we find spouses that are deployed where the male member of the family is there, and that's where the men of the church could come around that particular one. In addition, if there are children in that family, if there are young boys who could use some men from the church or some of the younger men, come around them, the same way for the young women. There are a host of ways that the body of Christ can minister to these folks that is really very affecting, and principally can extend the fact that the love of God is what really is going to bring them through those dark hours when there's fear that that spouse is really in danger.
Now, let's say that that a Christian or a Christian family is living in a neighborhood, and it's not a church situation, but just in the neighborhood. How can they really be supportive, and how can they really help and pray for and pray with, and at the same time hope for an opportunity for the gospel with this family?
Well, there are open opportunities under these circumstances that don't arise others, because people are genuinely much more open to spiritual things when they're in this situation. So I would offer that people need to prayerfully consider being very open to listen to what that individual might say to you in a situation, and see if there's that opportunity to offer the love of God in that, and to offer that peace. Invite to church, invite to any fellowship activities that are associated with the church, to take the kids, go to a movie, do anything where that person feels the contact of a human being in their life that really cares for them and the situation they find themselves in.
You know, most of us can get through a day without thinking about life and death. In modern America, we're busy with our jobs, our kids, our families. We go to the mall. We go to the soccer game. We're not thinking about life and death. But for these families, they're really thinking about life, death, and separation all the time.
Well, and that's really the challenge. You take a situation very similar to what we've experienced and what others are experiencing today, where a wife will be there with her small children. She cannot afford to focus her attention on that fact. She has to be a mother, or the father has to be a father to those children, or a friend. And that's really how you deal with it. If they don't have the Lord in their life, it becomes very, very difficult. And that's where the friendship of a believer can be very, very effective. Just extending the love of Jesus to those people is really valuable. And certainly, I believe, in consonance with what Jesus said about to go and share him. You share him with a meal. You share him with love. And that's really very effective today for these families.
Instruct us on how to pray for those in uniform and for their families.
Well, I believe that for the member who's deployed, that you certainly would pray for God's protection. You would pray for the wisdom of the leadership that he or she is under, that they would do the things that are best for that individual and most effective. For the family, pray for them to have peace and harmony, because that's generally when the kids are disruptive and sicknesses come. Pray for things to go well in that family.
Well, that's the kind of experienced word we really need. I think that it's just too rare that Christians have this kind of conversation. And just given our recent history in this country, there has been the luxury for most of us of not thinking too much about this. But now almost anywhere you live, just as General Caruana was saying, almost anywhere you live, you're likely to find in your midst, in your neighborhood, in the families associated with the Little League team, in your church, those who are in uniform, who are deployed, who are about to be deployed, who have been deployed, or whose loved ones are deployed. Back with final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Interesting, isn't it, that we face this great challenge? So many churches seem to be unaware of the challenge of ministering to those who are in uniform, and there are very particular challenges. And we talked about some of those in my interview with Lieutenant General Pat Caruana, retired Air Force general, dear friend, and one who has a lot to offer just in terms of advice for churches and for all of us about thinking of those in uniform. You know, many people right now may be thinking, well, you know, my church isn't close to a military base. This isn't a military, you know, concentration area. We really don't have a whole lot of military installation. You know, here's what you're probably missing. There are the direct family and the immediate family of many people in uniform around you right now. One of the things that we have done in this society over the past several decades is that we have made the military invisible through its extensions. You know, I can remember the conversations among those who were alive in World War II. I was not, but talked about the fact that when a household had someone in the war, there was a star put in the window. Even during Vietnam, often flags put out front or a yellow ribbon tied around the tree. Just a reminder to us that there are folks who are certainly near to us, if not already within the life of our congregation, who need that particular kind of care. Ministering to those in the military means taking honestly the fact that these are folks who do not have the kind of freedom and liberty that many others do. They have signed up in service of their country. They are under authority, and they are given orders. We may not have them for long. They may indeed be with us for a very short amount of time in a local church as they are moved around, but their needs are very real. They are suffering and struggling with some things that are unique to those who wear the uniform. And especially in this particular time, there are those in uniform who have served one, two, three different tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they're in serious need of the kind of appreciative, loving, brotherly, and sisterly ministry that can come most effectively through the local church. One of the things we read about is post-traumatic stress syndrome, and particularly as PTSD is experienced by some who have left the war. This post-battle and post-armed services, post-war trauma comes into the lives of people who just cannot get out of their mind some of the experiences they had in war. Let's remember, they had those experiences on our behalf. They were there for us. They were there because we needed them there. They were wearing the uniform that represents us all, and for that reason, we need to be remembering them, not only in terms of every once in a while mentioning our appreciation, but our churches need to arrange our ministries in such a way that we have them very much in mind. It's been good to have this conversation today. I hope you and your family have had a marvelous Memorial Day weekend, and that as you travel home, you do so safely. The summer is out before us. One of the things families need to do right now is figure out in the stewardship of time what you're going to do together as you celebrate not only Memorial Day, but the coming summer. Keep in mind, this is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. Day by day, I'll meet you here. Thanks for listening to the Albert Miller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.